the Washington, D.C. region. Then the county staff report on MPDUs, and we strongly agree that the program does require an overhaul at the end of basically a very successful 30-year history. We support the intention of the proposed legislation to correct critical shortcomings in the program and strongly urge the board to consider all measures that will achieve the most MPDUs in housing near high-frequency transit nodes and corridors. I'd like to just touch upon several of the issues that were brought up in both bills 2504 and 2404 and the CTAs. In terms of the control period, we strongly support Bill 2504 extending to 99 years with the provision for MPDU Preservation Fund and an MPDU Rehabilitation Fund. We support Bill 2504's recommendation to reduce the size of subdivisions covered from 35 to 20 units. In high-rise zones, we support a solution that could offer a certain level of compensation for building MPDUs in places that are constrained by master plan limits. 2504's proposal of reducing from 12.5% to 10% in high-rise buildings where there's height restrictions limited by the master plan might be part of the solution, or modest exceptions in zoning could also yield room for MPDUs. We strongly support unbundling high condo and homeowner association fees that are proposed by Bill 2504 to separate out non-essential fees that are currently preventing a lot of otherwise eligible households from having the opportunity to live in an MPDU. And we'd like to see explicit language about automobile parking as a non-essential cost be incorporated into that proposal to make that optional, that people aren't forced to buy parking that they would rather spend on housing or other household expenditures. Regarding buyouts, we support Bill 2504, limiting buyouts to senior and special needs housing. We are interested in the proposals in 2404 that try to provide more stringent off-site mitigation kinds of measures that might be appropriate. In terms of sort of the most controversial proposals related to modifying densities in high-rise zones, we support the intent of the ZTAs proposed by Councilmember Florine and her colleagues to address the problem of density limitations preventing MPDUs being produced all on site in high-rise development districts. But we, as the staff has expressed, we also disagree with the level of permissiveness that's been offered in these ZTAs. And there's been some suggestions for ways to moderate rather than just make these wide open sorts of exceptions in order to achieve MPDUs on site. And there's a lot of need to tighten up that language to make sure we're talking about on-site MPDUs and not necessarily all of the density bonus that might be going along with that. And so we strongly support sort of the expression of caution by the staff to look at what kinds of flexibility can we provide to overcome most of the barriers for including 12.5 MPDUs on-site in constrained districts like the Central Business District. And I just also wanted to note that we do not support adding MPDU requirements for large lot zones far from urban infrastructure, really not very convenient for households who need to be better connected into the transportation system. And we do support the SRA 04-1 regarding the reduction of width of tertiary roads. There's a lot of much too wide roads required in development standards today anyway. So those are sort of a summary of my comments. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Nancy?
For the record, my name is Nancy Wendt. I'm the president of the Olney Coalition. That's who I'm representing today. I will limit my comments today to concepts. Our board met last night. We will follow up with detailed comments on each of these pieces of legislation, and you, of course, will be copied as you have always been. Our first observation, we think the affordable housing crisis in Montgomery County is serious, and it deserves a serious, comprehensive, integrated solution. Council staff, the report that was given in February, was very clear on the point that the MPDU program has been successful. It needs some adjustments, particularly because we're moving from greenfield development in suburbs to doing more development in down county and central business district areas. We favor the recommendations in that report, and we were very surprised that they were not paid more attention in this legislation. We would ask you to send the council back to take another look at what their staff asked them to do. The thing I think that is perhaps the most worrisome to us, and I think that Ginny Barnes probably said it as close to the way my board is telling me, this packet of legislation opens the door to interpretations that could seriously erode the general plan, the master plan, the sector plans, and zoning standards. We think that is a major mistake. We think that we need a solution. We think fixing the MPDU program, making adjustments for the kind of development we're facing now, is very appropriate, but it should be done within the context of that planning framework. And it should definitely have community input every step of the way. It should be a transparent and open process. We would also recommend that some consideration be given to strengthening the guidance to master plans. Right now, every master plan is supposed to have a housing chapter. We think there should be more specific guidance on what should be in that master planning chapter. We think it should include an assessment of how much affordable housing is located where within the master plan area, how much is needed, and what's the best way to provide it. And that should be dealt with in the master plan. Other than that, I think that's really at the conceptual level. We think it's important to look at ways to relax some of the things that have become obstacles to providing the affordable housing we need. But we don't think this packet of legislation does it in an intelligent way, and we think it opens you to eroding things that are very valuable to the county and should be strengthened. Thank you.
Thank you. John Clark.
Good afternoon. Chairman Balazs, members of the Planning Commission, I am John Clark, Vice President of MNCBIA for Montgomery County. I've also served for several years as co-chair of our MPDU task force. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on all the proposed MPDU changes before you. In the interest of time, I will not read all of it, but just kind of speak generally and then to some of the specifics if there's time available. The process that generated most, if not all, of the provisions before you was a result of then-Council President Subin's directive in July 2003 to Council staff. How would the MPDU law be different if it were written today rather than 30 years ago? We do not believe Council staff answered this question in the 160-page document generated in February of this year. We believe instead that they answered the question, how would you modify the existing MPDU law for 2004? While this distinction may be a fine line, we believe it is the difference between slightly modifying the status quo versus thinking outside the box, a very necessary difference in approach in order to create bold new ideas that address not only affordable housing shortfalls, but an increasing crisis of housing affordability. We believe Council staff was given a blank slate to write bold new legislation, and all they did really was play around the edges. We believe the recommendations could have gone much further. Here are a few examples. Allow accessory apartments by right in all zones. This will provide necessary affordable housing that can be used by elderly people, single persons, and low-income earners having trouble finding affordable housing. Encourage more housing and therefore more MPDUs for the fastest-growing sector of our population over 55 or 60 years of age by removing special exception requirements for senior housing and streamlining the approval process. Find ways to encourage more rental MPDUs in the program. Rental MPDUs over the life of the control period will serve the needs of more families than owned MPDUs. And find ways to encourage redevelopment of aging commercial and industrial properties with an MPDU by right overlay zone. Unfortunately, options like this are not before us, so therefore I will testify on the proposed changes. First, MNCBIA offers two simple premises in our approach to the MPDU program. Premise number one, let us build to bonus density, including MPDUs. Let the program's basic principles rely on the original premise from Section 25A-2, number 6, that it is the public policy of the county to ensure that private developers constructing MPDUs under this chapter incur no loss or penalty as a result thereof and have reasonable prospects of realizing a profit on such units by virtue of the MPDU density bonus provisions of Chapter 59. This principle is the premise for the bonus density provisions in the NPDU table in Section 25A. When this program was created, achieving base and bonus density was possible on properties that were easier to develop amidst a world with few regulations reducing developable area. Today, our developable area per parcel is less, and building and development costs are much higher. We need to find ways to achieve base and bonus density. And premise number two is let us be fairly reimbursed for the cost to develop and construct the NPDUs. Our basic positions can be summarized in those two principles. With regard to the individual amendments, we agree in general with the ZTAs and the SRA because they provide more flexibility to provide NPDUs on site. On ZTA 014 and SRA 041, I would object to the staff's recommendation to provide additional NPDUs above the percentages for either of those requirements. The benefit of these provisions is that it will allow us for more flexible land planning, better design, and possibly the ability to even get to that minimum threshold. If we start putting additional bonus or NPDU requirements on us, we may not be able to get to the 35-unit level because we have to then provide additional NPDUs to get more flexibility. Bills 2404 and 2504, just some general comments on them. One thing I think that very much we feel needs to be looked at are the income levels. We strongly support a second tier of income eligibility at 80 to 90% of the median to help make the program more fair and help us build the units economically in high-cost areas such as high-rise. Additionally, this higher income tier can help reach the income levels of some of our civil servants, part of the original target of the program. The current income limit for a one-person household to live in an NPDU is $38,000. However, a police officer candidate makes $38,500 per year and a starting teacher makes $39,000 per year, both above the NPDU eligibility level. If either are married with the other spouse working, then the $42,000 income limit for a two-person household is unattainable. The only way to qualify would be for one of the spouses not to work. We're against elimination of buyouts. We think providing flexibility is important, but we are willing to have a working group be formed to create a transparent process so that people know up front if there is a buyout that what that price would be. In general, we appreciate the opportunity to participate in this important discussion. We are interested in finding ways to make the system work better for all parties and build NPDUs in an economically viable and fair manner. We will continue to participate as things progress to the County Council, and we're available to answer any questions you may have related to our testimony or the legislation.
I have a couple questions. First, on the idea that your parking spaces would not be included, would there be some regulatory requirement devised to make clear that when you sign for the unit, no car?
Well, currently parking is sold separately in some development, basically.
So basically you'd have mandatory unbundling.
It would be unbundling. That housing for cars is separate from the paying for housing for people.
And, John Clark, you lost me at one point in your testimony. You said that the 35-unit, you're saying that if we put more requirements for NPDUs in the legislation, that the economies of scale won't permit you to get to the 35, afford the 35 units, even if you're getting additional bonus units because we're waiving things?
No.
Is that what you were saying?
If, for example, you had a community where without under the normal provisions of the zone, you could get to 30 units. And then with either 100% townhouses or the reduced-width tertiary, you could get above the threshold, which is 35 to maybe 38 units. But now the percentage of NPDUs that you have to provide may have an undesired consequence of actually giving you a negative incentive to try to put the NPDUs on the property.
But wouldn't that go to the sliding scale we were that came up in our general discussion, because your NPDU obligation at 30 units, let's say, is zero, it would go to 25 under the bill. But
well, whatever that level is, to me, the incentive should be let's create ways to create better land plans and more flexibility to actually get to that 35, whatever that threshold is, without penalizing us above where we are today, which the 100% or the tertiary reduction would actually allow you to get to the threshold, instead of penalizing us by saying, okay, now you have to provide the 12.5%, it's now 14% or something like that.
Are you saying there should be no NPDU units until you get to the 35-unit level, say hypothetically, or there should be I'm not quite sure that the requirement should be the same or that the bonus should be graduated. It's not clear to me what you're saying.
I'm saying that the percentage should be the same as it is today, allowing people just to achieve the MPDUs and the on-site.
So the waiver of the regulatory requirements gets you to 35 units, and then you only would only have the requirement to provide 12.5%.
Whatever that percentage is in relation to the existing table, yes.
Any other questions?
I just have a couple questions, mm-hmm. just in terms of the experience of the building industry. The way things are right now with the current law, have there been problems with the MPDU program other than the well-publicized problems with the high-rise from the point of view of the builders? You're right. The original legislation, I mean, you put it in your testimony, but that was one of the statements that one of the goals was that the people who are providing these will make a fair profit, and it works within the market. It's market-driven. Have there been problems other than the high-rises in terms of building the MPDUs?
Part of the problem is just Montgomery County as it approaches build-out in general. You have harder to develop pieces of property, which in a more regulated world than 30 years ago when the original law was written. So we think it is harder to sometimes get to your base density. And I'm talking now not about high-rises or multifamily, just in normal suburban subdivisions. It's harder to get to base density, and also our development costs are much greater. And that's a result of just cost in general, regulation, but also as you get to smaller and smaller communities, your per-unit costs go up. So to us, one way to help deal with that is maybe the second tier or higher levels. We think affordability is higher now. Based upon median income levels, but also as a way to try and reach a broader population.
Sort of the ratio between, you know, the unit cost, mm-hmm. and the high unit cost to the MPDU unit cost would be closer together. They wouldn't be so. What is it? The maximum now is $166,000 you can pay for an MPDU.
I'm not sure what the maximum is, but typically we don't get to that number. I mean, we're in the 110s, 120s for townhouses, but it's also trying to find ways to actually provide the units on site and through, that's what I think one of the benefits of more flexible development standards to create more flexibility in land planning, but actually create better land plans. I mean, we've got a zoning ordinance that is 30 years old also, where we didn't have as many constraints years ago, whether they're, you know, for environmental reasons or whatever reasons exist. And so ways to allow us to create more creative land plans, with compatibility still being an issue, and ways to actually fit the densities on the property.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The last group is Shirley Lynn, Pamela Lindstrom, and Bob Harris. Go ahead, Shirley.
Okay. For the record, I'm Shirley Lynn, residing at 2014 Glen Haven Place, Silver Spring, Maryland. For over 25 years, I have been an advocate for affordable housing for everyone, especially the disabled. As a member of the Board of Appeals, I supported the establishment of Inwood House, which is subsidized housing for the disabled. As president of the Wheaton Forest Civic Association, I am also an advocate of protecting and preserving existing moderately priced communities. The proposed changes on the MPDU laws does not preserve and support existing communities. Rather, it is harmful and abrogates the assurances the zoning laws gave to home buyers the last 50 years. The building coverage of lot line to lot line is a terrible suggestion, an abomination. Open green space and trees should be maintained at 45%. Not just for aesthetics, but for health reasons, for the entire community. Trees absorb carbon dioxide and give off oxygen that we need to breathe. Additional MPDUs can be provided by permitting height limitations to be lifted to 10 to 15 stories. Georgia Avenue from Pritchard Road to Reedy Drive was approved for 200 feet height more than 10 years ago by Park and Planning and the County Council. The developer doesn't choose to go this route because steel and concrete construction, as required, is more expensive. The Metropolitan Building of Bethesda is considered their crown jewel by HOC. It is a high-rise building with MPDU units, rich foliage, trees, and fountains, and other amenities. That is the type of construction that should be your goal. No one would doubt that Norman Cristello was a strong advocate for MPDU construction, but he also recognized the importance of green space and public amenities to be provided by the developer. The beauty contest held for new buildings in the Bethesda CBD required public amenities and open space. The University Towers and Warwick Towers on University Boulevard West are 18-story structures with open space, trees, and a pool. If you are going to have high-rise buildings, you must have open space, and you do not need to build lot line to lot line to provide 15% of MPDUs. The developer gains 22% additional units. These higher densities should result in higher profits for developers. I support the council's attempt to prevent developers' buyout of MPDU obligations. Penalizing them 25% over the cost of construction may prevent the buyout. Certainly not to allow a pittance of $21,000 per unit contribution as a buyout. I approve the requirement that occupants of MPDUs be required to offer the county the right of first refusal if they wish to sell their MPDUs, and that the control period by the county be 30 years instead of 10 years. I moved to Montgomery County because of the promise of a high quality of life for me and my family. These proposed changes negatively impact the entire community. It is not an appropriate area. It is not cost-effective trade-offs to equalize the additional MPDUs at the expense of the existing communities. And I'll be glad to answer any questions. I mean, I really want to make clear that I am an advocate of affordable housing, but it's not what you do, it's the way how you do it. And the way that they're proposing is just dead wrong.
Thank you. Pam.
I am Pamela Lindstrom from Gaithersburg. I hadn't really planned to speak today, but several environmental group people couldn't come at the last minute, and they wanted to speak. They wanted it clear how important they think this issue is, and in particular that they and I do see a real strong need to get more affordable housing in the transit station areas. However, what I want to talk about is getting the 12.5% required MPDUs built in the dense urban zones. Again, I will refer back to the council staff report. Also, the ZTAs and even your staff haven't really discussed how to get the 12.5% built on site. And I would support relaxations in the development standards in those zones sufficient to make it feasible to get the 12.5% required built on site, eliminating the need for buyouts. And I just wanted to talk to you a moment about the effect of the ZTAs as written on the Shady Grove Sector Plan, something fairly near and dear to my heart, and I assume you all's too. As far as I know, all those developments are supposed to be accommodated in one or two zones. Now, those zones, I assume, are going to have fairly high maximum height limits, right, to accommodate all the different building styles that you want in that sector plan. And I don't see anything in these zoning text amendments to say that a developer can come in and say, I want to build an eight-story building on Route 355 instead of a four-story building on Route 355. It's allowed in the zone, and I will provide bonus MPDUs, and I expect the bonus density. And I don't see anything in this text amendments that say that the planning board can say no. And I will leave it at that.
Thank you. Mr. Harris?
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, Bob Harris. I'm speaking as an individual today. As we all, I think, are recognizing, we have a housing crisis in the county, both market and affordable units, and I applaud the planning board and the council members who have endorsed opportunities here to provide for both, particularly today focusing on affordable housing. We're working to create more incentives for MPDUs and more flexibility to achieve them, and I applaud that. We need these new tools if we expect the private sector to provide affordable housing for the public's benefit and to make sure that there is no net loss for them. I want to add a few other items to the mix, though, because I think unless we address some of these other constraints, we haven't really provided sufficient opportunities. One particular focus, the first of three, is the CBD zones. Most zones allow reduced setbacks, greater unit types, and greater densities in order to offset the MPDUs. And we're talking in these text amendments about allowing a bonus density in the CBD zones. And John walked you through his concept earlier, and that seems reasonable to me. But what we haven't focused on is the height in the CBD zones. We've said we would lift the master plan ceiling where that is below the zoning ordinance maximum, but we're not talking about lifting the 60, 90, 143-foot height in those zones. That would still apply, and that's a little unfair because we don't even have a height limit in TSM, TSR, RH, a number of the other multifamily zones, or other town center-type zones, but yet we have a height limit in the CBD, which is where we're trying to get these units, and we ought to allow a 22% increase in that height limit imposed on the zone if we're putting MPDUs in there, because it's not just a density issue. Often the height is the ceiling that keeps you from developing those units. Secondly, we ought to consider the ability to provide the public use space, whatever the requirement is, off-site in some of these CBD instances where we have smaller parcels and we have to do the public use space on-site. Many times it turns out to be less than effective and meaningful space, and it would be helpful if we could combine that public use space somewhere else off-site or on public ground and do something that's more beneficial to the public. Again, this would be tied to providing the MPDUs on-site, as you've proposed. Thirdly, I do support the buyouts. I don't think it's something that is universally necessary, but there are a number of instances where there are special circumstances where buyouts are appropriate. And I know it's offensive to the general public, and some people don't appreciate the full economics of it, but particularly in high-rise condominiums with high amenities, there is a propriety of buyouts, and I do endorse retaining that. I see my time is up.
Yeah.
Geico was only 200 townhouses, by the way, not 500. It's 500 total units. The other 300 are multifamily.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions?
This is a question for Mr. Harris. My discussion with John earlier, we had the example of 150 units, 120 units. 150 units is the maximum in the zone, 120 in the master plan. Your position seems to be, well, really ought to be able to go to the bonus on top of the 150 units, but I think a legitimate concern is, in a sense, notice to the public. The limitation in the master plan is 120 units. Your proposal would look like it'd be 20% on top of 150. How do you propose to advise someone that comes and reads the master plan that they may be looking at,
okay,
20% on top of 150 and not 20% on top of 120?
Let me clarify. I hadn't focused on that, but what I was referring to is an instance where the zone says 150 units. The master plan is silent. You ought to be able to do MPDUs on top of the 150 units that the zone allows.
Well, I think that's
not in the text amendments,
yes,
now, though, is what I'm saying, at least as I understand that.
Well, there seems to be some disagreement about that in terms of how the language reads, but...
Oh.
I've asked a question about the notice issue, so if you have any thoughts
on yours, I can appreciate what you're saying. I think at a minimum you should be able to go bonus on top of what the master plan says if it's below the zoning cap, and I'll reserve judgment on the other by night.
All right.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Yes. I was intrigued by what you said regarding the buyout, indicating that you thought that there were some circumstances where, in fact, buyouts should occur because it just makes good economic sense. And I'm not dissuaded from that idea. I guess my concern is when the buyout are so minuscule in terms of the value of the property that that's where I think people become enraged and see the inequity of the situation. What is your position from that standpoint in terms of your understanding about buyouts and the relevance of the formula that's used depending on where you are and who the builder is, et cetera?
I think some of the concern about those numbers is that housing values have changed so dramatically in the last several years, and some of the examples of the values are based on older projects. Cameron Hill here in Silver Spring, one of the first of that sort. Housing values have quadrupled since then, if not quintupled. I think that there is a way to figure a fair value that it doesn't offend the general public as a giveaway, but yet is, you know, reasonable for developers, and I think it would be higher than a lot of those old buyout values. Mm.
If you were talking to your colleagues at the Building Industry Association, would you be suggesting to them that as part of this notion about setting up a task force, a committee, that might be one of the things that they might want to set up also to look at formula for the buyouts? And the example for me is that a very significant project in Bethesda, the buyout was $21,000 per unit, whereas another project, smaller, in Northern Bethesda / Potomac area, the buyout came to close to, I think if I recall correctly, something like $109,000 per unit. Mm-hmm. And that kind of discursive difference is just enough to enrage a person when you see one developer is willing to do what seemingly is come as close as possible to the market rate of what it actually costs to build, whereas in another circumstance you have a person essentially walking away with a pocket full of money, if I might use that expression.
I understand. The economics of those projects, and I'm not familiar, I know which projects you're referring to, or I think I do, and I don't know the economics, but I can guess that the economics of each project are vastly different, and it may, you know, affect that. But I appreciate your suggestion. I think that is something I should take back to the industry, and we'll try to come up with something that is appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. It's now time for us to decide what kind of advice we want to give to the County Council on this package of amendments. I think that we should go through the cheat sheet, use that as at least the framework for the discussion, although obviously we can we'll refer to the longer packet as well.
May I make a suggestion? I go along with the idea of resorting to the cheat sheet, but this is just my bias. I think it's important, whatever we do, is to start off with a preamble. And there's a preamble that I think I'm hearing, and that is that in terms of the notion about MPDUs and trying to provide more, there is consensus that there is a need for more MPDUs. I think that whatever we communicate, we ought to communicate that we are in agreement with that consensus. Our concern is about the particular legislation and what it is proposing individually, but in terms of conceptually, we're all in agreement with the MPDU need for additional MPDUs. And I think that's important to say.
I certainly agree with that. Does anyone disagree with that?
I agree with it, and like MPDUs that are built on site.
On site.
Okay.
Right. Well, I guess I'd say there's on-site and there's also the possibility of that we've, I think we've talked about in other contexts, of not on the site of a particular project, but provided by the builder, maybe providing off-site, but not cash, providing actual units. So where I come back to on this sort of preliminary is there's a need for more MPDUs that are actually built, whether they're built on site or someplace else. But the problem is that there was monies have been paid. We don't have units to show for them. So there's a need for MPDUs, and there's a need for them to be in existence, not simply around in theory.
And then I would add, and this is just in the legislation, that are geographically dispersed.
Yeah, I agree with that.
That was the original intent of the legislation, that moderately priced dwelling units should be built and dispersed throughout the county. And that, I think, that there, goal hasn't changed. They didn't amend that either.
There's nothing that I've heard that changes the thrust of what I wanted to communicate, and so I endorse the two perspectives that you're bringing and that you're adding to it.
Okay.
So what happens, the policy is we want the MPDUs on site, but it could mean that they're not directly on the site. There's some value to the MPDU, and whatever that value is, we want to see MPDUs elsewhere result from that value, because there's got to be some way of measuring, you know, the economics of the alternative MPDU type MPDU units that
that's
Commissioner
kind of,
Purdue was talking about.
It's convoluted the way you said it, but I agree.
They don't magically appear somewhere else. There has to be some way of measuring the value.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let them, you know, this unit over here is worth $100, and they go build a $20 MPDU unit somewhere else and say it's dollar for dollar. That's one unit one for one. It's got to be dollar for dollar.
And I think there's a second thing that I heard, and I didn't detect there would be a lack of consensus on it, and that is that when it comes to amenities that are required as a result of the master plan, that we're not endorsing anything that modifies the need for amenities. Because, you see, this is my value, because the amenity package is being thought out in terms of the broader need of the geographic area that's being considered, whereas when it comes to a particular zoning text amendment that we're talking about, that can be localized to a particular parcel or lot, whatever the case may be, or site. And you don't want to negate the whole for the benefit of the specific or part. So does that make sense?
I certainly agree with that. I don't want to go out of order of what the chairman wanted to go by the cheat sheet, and that's not on the cheat sheet. But when you talk about amenities, you're talking about what's in the master plan.
What's been recommended in the master plan.
Right. And so I've struggled over this legislation, as I now hear that many of us have, and I think a critical question here is this idea that I think one speaker raised, that somehow it is severing, for the first time in any legislation I've ever seen, it's severing the zones from the master plan. Normally we have language that either says it has to be consistent with the master plan or refers back. This doesn't do that. And so the way it's written now, we have a situation where either density or height or both can be completely different from a master plan, and you don't know it. The master plan says one thing, and the zone says something else. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe in Montgomery County, when you buy a piece, when you buy a home, when you're at the settlement, you sign a sheet that you've seen the master plan and you know about it, and that's your document. Is that right, Charlie?
I didn't do that.
You can go back to your closing lawyer.
That's correct.
And now you'd be signing that piece of paper, and unbeknownst to you, No, actually, what could really happen is if someone were to even try to achieve MPDUs, right now the way it's written, I'm not sure you even have to do any of them. It could be a completely, completely different looking building that, in fact, depending on the zone, you couldn't even describe, because if it's the TSM or the TSR zone, there's so few standards, you have no idea, no height limitations. So I think we need to go back, and once the council staff integrated the master plans with the MPDU changes, they did it consistently throughout their recommendations. They said that if for the large lot, the RNC, you couldn't recommend it unless there was a recommendation in the master plan for sewer. They said if there was a height change, you needed to have limited amendments to the master plan. They said where master plan densities were affected, once again, you needed limited amendments. And I think that's the way to go about it. We already said and have included, and someone else testified, we should be doing more in our master plans about affordable housing. The chairman already has included that, but we need to do even more, perhaps, as she was saying, an inventory, and identify the sites, that, you know, through the master plan process that could have these standards lifted. And, in fact, even in the council staff report on their recommendation for the green space where they said there should be times when you don't have to have the same setbacks and the same restrictions, they recommended that only in the situations where the sector plan had put in height limits. So it was a way to deal, to stay within the sector plan requirement by changing the green space requirements. They didn't do as this legislation suggests, just do it across the board, whether, no matter what, you know, a sector plan says. So I agree with you about amenities, but I think it needs to be broader than that. I think we need to do this the way we've always done this. After all, we've got 11,000 MPDUs that were done under the process we've always followed. We are the, for 30 years, the council report points that out, no other jurisdiction in the United States has achieved what we had under this planning process. So I think we've got to stick with our process, but just amend the law to get at the problems that were identified. That we've, since 2000 with the buyouts, we've lost 231 MPDUs. So I would focus on that problem, and I would do it within the same planning process we've always used. So I would not, I would recommend to the council that they reconsider the language that says that you can ignore the sector plan when it comes to density, the master plans or the sector plans when it comes to density or height, in order to achieve MPDUs.
Well, that's the fourth issue on the cheat sheet. We'll get there.
Okay.
We'll get there. Ready to go through the individual concepts?
Okay.
Okay. The first one is eliminating the building coverage requirement and allowing a reduction in the green area requirement in all multiple family residential zones. Greg, could you state again what you guys are recommending on that?
What we're recommending on, which is ZTA 04-11, what we're recommending is, first of all, the green area requirement that's been proposed in the original text amendment is 20%. And it's reducing, anywhere from 45 to 53%, which is currently in the multifamily. We're recommending that we take that from 20% to 35%, consistent with how the TSR, TSM zones relate to open space and green area.
So in all the multifamily zones, the minimum green area would be 35% if you're building your MPDUs on site. Is that right? Or
just
is this dependent on the MPDUs being on site, or is this just across the board?
Just across the board.
So this is no matter what you're doing, we would drop it to drop it to 35%, and then we'd have we wouldn't have a lot coverage requirement at all,
right?
Because obviously, with a green area of 35%,
and
you cover that issue
as well as setback requirements that are,
and the setbacks are still
green area does not green area does not include parking lots and such. As I would assume, right. I would assume. Now, I gather the theory here for looking at the TSM zone, the other zone as the model, that those are the densest zones that are available for multifamily. And if you can live with 35% there in the densest zone, you can live with 35% everywhere else.
Well, the CBDs are 20%. The TSRs are sort of in the middle, I guess.
Yeah, so why not the CBD requirement?
That was the 20%.
And why not that one if that's the densest zone? I'm not saying that I'm not supporting it, that I'm not receptive to the 35%. I'd just like you to articulate a little bit more what your model is.
I think there's two reasons. One, in a central business district situation, we always have the step-down effect from the transit station. These multifamily are on the edge of the area, and so in theory you might have a little bit more, a larger green space requirement. The other reason is these are throughout the county. They're mostly adjacent to commercial areas as well. So you're kind of you have a central business district situation, and you have a lot of them that are out throughout the county. So I thought CBD requirements is a little too low.
Well, to pursue that point, first of all, I don't understand the relationship between the green space requirement and the outer fringes of the CBD zone, where you still have 20% because arguably it's lower density. There's a little bit different thread in your argument about the CBD zone, which I have some considerable sympathy for, is that I mean, if you want to live in a CBD zone, you know you're living in a city.
Yeah.
Right? And in cities we have concrete and fewer trees. That's what cities are about. If you're out in someplace else, you know that you want more green coverage because it's not a city.
Right.
You know? I mean, that seems to be what you're saying, really, is because it's countywide, the urbanization or the density of the environment that's being created shouldn't be at the 20% level.
That's the second reason, yeah.
Yeah, I don't understand the first reason because it seems to have some concept of FAR, floor area ratio lurking behind it that you're not articulating.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing about the CBDs is those are mostly existing. Almost all of our multifamily zones are built out, so this is a redevelopment proposal. So to the extent that they're built out at the larger green space requirements, maybe we shouldn't go to the minimums in the central business district.
So it's partly it's a combination of expectations.
Yes.
Okay.
And compatibility. It's adjacent to the single family.
What I'm going back and looking at your discussion on the item. I'm looking at pages, principally page 5, but also 4 and 5, where you're talking about 0411. Now, I see the reference to the floor area. And you talk about it from the standpoint also of the optional method.
Now, this is just the multifamily zones.
Only the multifamily zones,
yeah,
right.
We're just talking about the
And the reason for the idea of saying 35% rather than 20% is because of the fact that we're now eliminating the coverage requirement. And so, therefore, that would give a person, a developer, a lot of options, a lot more options.
Right, right.
But in return, we're saying, regardless of the option, we want to make sure that there is adequate green space.
Right.
So there's the compatibility issue.
Is that right?
Okay.
And I thought you don't need a green space and a coverage requirement.
Right, right.
How does the coverage area restrict? How would a coverage area restrict a property more than 35% green space?
Well, the way it is today, there's a 20% coverage maximum. 20% is your maximum coverage today. And then there is a green space requirement that varies from roughly 45 to 53%.
Okay.
So that this would eliminate the coverage and just emphasize what we're really interested in, which is the green space.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. So the economics here are we're going to 35% coverage. Presently have a, say, a three-story apartment complex that's
yes.
subject to the 20% rule. Okay. Tear down the three-story complex, go to 35% coverage, more units, and whatever happens to result mechanically, the MTD PDU requirements follow from that. So the leverage
right.
here really is increasing the total housing stock
right.
in the context of these existing developments
right.
and from there generating more MPDUs without
right.
regard to any of the other changes that are proposed in the text amendments.
Right. This just affects the multifamily.
Right. I think I understand this, and I think I agree with it. I just need you to use a concrete example for me. And my concrete example would be the parcel we were talking about on Villiers Mill Road.
That's
you
a
knew
perfect
that's
example.
What I was going to talk about, right?
That's a perfect example.
And that's a perfect example of this.
That's right.
Okay. See, now I understand. I can agree with this.
Well, I think this one makes economic sense, and it also achieves a different, an important goal also, I think, which is standardization of the zoning code in terms of issues, and that's an objective.
Yes,
that shouldn't
that
drive the
aspect.
Basic decision, but it does lead to more uniformity in terms of how these zones are viewed and both the, you might say, the compatibility and business expectations of everyone involved. It will provide uniform notice. And
okay.
I think that's helpful.
One down, five to go.
Oh, wait, I haven't.
Oh.
No.
One not down yet.
Yeah, well, on the green space. Yeah. Yeah, no, on the green space, depending on how the rest of this thing were written, this could work for me. But in the context of something that is so open and amorphous, I'm concerned about it. One, two reasons. One, we seem to still not be clear on what the purpose of the legislation is. For me, it's just to cure the problem of the MPDU, strengthen the MPDU problem. I'm not really addressing right now the bigger problem of how we get more affordable units in general. I think that should be addressed separately, and so it sounds like when I hear from my colleagues that really, you know, what the really great thing about this is you'll just get a lot more units. The problem I have with that is that I don't have a context for it, and as they were asking for examples, you know, I was trying to, you know, that's what we need. We need examples, and we need to know how it would work in specific situations rather than just, especially since it isn't the cure for the MPDU problem anyway. I mean, one of the questions we'll get to later is if we just hadn't allowed the buyout since 2000 or if we'd unbundled fees, we might not even have to be going through this whole rigmarole. But the other thing that made me have pause about it was in reading the memo from our staff about this, you all noted that this text amendment could result in as many as 800 additional housing units, including 120 MPDUs in the Bethesda CBD.
With that, my triangle, yeah.
With my, okay. Well, that could be great, but that should be master planned. 800 units is a huge change. You know, it would be one thing if you told me, well, you know, you change this green space requirement, now you're going to have 30, 40 more units. But that's not what you're saying. You're saying 800 more units. So what I will be trying to say later on is, you know, when you get into large incremental changes, that's what master plans are all about, not zoning text amendments. You start doing major planning by zoning text amendments, and you're doing it property by property, or you're doing it, you're flying blind, basically. So this one I'll just reserve judgment. There are situations, doing it the way the council staff recommended, where I also support it. You would need to do it in order to deal with the sector plan height requirements, or as I'll say later, you just change the sector plan height requirements by amendment. But the way it is right now, no, I think it has.
Well, I have some additional question for staff in light of my
colleagues' comments. First of all, assume that we change the underlying zone, the way your zones, the way you're recommended, so that they're uniform. They'd still be subject to local area transportation review, any project, school review. They'd still be subject to any limitations that were in the master plan.
Right.
That's a separate issue. Now, we may be taking the limitations off the master plan. That creates a problem. I think we're all concerned about that. But proceeding through this, we're changing, suggesting the recommendation is because, in part, there's a broad housing crisis. The recommendation addresses a broader housing crisis. It addresses the need to rehabilitate or expand older housing stock by creating incentives for it. It creates a uniform policy. It creates more units. An affordable housing policy problem is ultimately a problem of lack of units. More supply, more affordability. There are consequences that flow from that. So this proposed change changes the underlying zone, but doesn't change any limitations in the master plan. It doesn't change any controls on development review in terms of local area transportation review right. or the school system, and that's why it doesn't trouble me.
Yeah. But the rest of the provisions do. So how
well,
can
then
you
let's deal with the rest of deal with the rest of the provisions when we get to them, rather than torpedoing what's basically a good, sound, basic land use concept because of concerns about the changes that might occur in specific master plans. Those are two different issues. So I will still support this recommendation.
Okay. Well, Commissioner Wellington's reserving judgment, which is fine. Let's go on to residential density bonuses in the CBD and transit station zones. You want to remind us of your recommendation, Craig?
Our recommendation is, that the residential
density... This is the bar chart, basically, right? This thing.
Yes. The residential density bonus over the base density and residential FER to be increased for a project in a CBD or transit station zone. Let's see. Give you the specific. That's actually ZTA 04-12.
Right. So if all MPDUs are on site, you could increase your FAR by the same proportion as you could increase the number of units and other types of zones.
Exactly. And also, actually, which is the line after that, that's part of the same CTA. It relates to the public use space. Now, the line there isn't clear in terms of...
Maybe you should take care of this one first.
Okay. We're not talking about public use space yet. We're just talking about increases in FAR.
Yeah, the issue is FAR right now in the CBD zones under a mixed use concept is not addressed in terms of the MPDU requirements. But if it's an all residential development, it is addressed from that standpoint.
Right.
And we're trying to clarify.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I think I could probably just clarify. So what we're talking about right now, the second row on the cheat sheet, is in a CBD or transit station zone, if you put all your MPDUs on site, then you would be able to get an FAR that is greater than what you can get today. The increase would be the same scale as we use in the MPDU program generally, so it would be up to a maximum of 22% FAR increase. But they're saying compute the 22% only on the residential portion of a mixed-use project. Mr. Bryant earlier raised the question of whether maybe you'd want to let them boost their commercial instead, and he may want to raise that again, but the staff recommendation is just compute the bonus on the residential portion.
But
does mean that in CBDs you could now get, using the optional method, you could get more FAR than you can get today with this if you put all your MPDUs on site, and how much more depends on whether you're doing the straight 12.5% or you're going all the way to 15.
Right. FAR is a function of what's embedded in the zoning code, not anything that's stated in the master plan. So, again, it's a mechanical calculation based on the present
FAR.